This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin today with politics and how Massachusetts is suddenly front and center in the battle for control of the Democratic Party. Come January, Democrats will be in the majority in the House, but an insurgency led by Seth Moulton, the Democratic congressman from Salem, is pushing for new leadership in the party and is trying to block Nancy Pelosi's bid to return as Speaker.
This is about change, including the broad coalition of women who were just newly elected and made a promise to vote for someone other than her, then you'll see this is about change for our entire party.
Moulton and 15 other representatives, including Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, released a letter vowing to oppose Pelosi just this afternoon. Moulton is under fire from a number of liberal activists who back Pelosi and who give her credit for this past election in which Democrats did so well in congressional races across the country. Moulton will face some of those critics and supporters at a town hall meeting this evening in Amesbury. And by the way, we should say that we've asked him to come on Radio Boston every day since the elections, but so far he hasn't accepted. Let's hear now from Congressman Richard Neal, representing Massachusetts' 1st Congressional District, which covers parts of the western part of the state. Neal's also the longest-serving member of Congress from Massachusetts who supports Pelosi and who will be taking over the chairmanship of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee come January. Congressman Neal, great to have you back on Radio Boston. Thank you.
Thanks, Anthony. Nice to be with you.
Let me start with you about this big story. Why do you support Nancy Pelosi's bid to become Speaker?
Well, I think the better argument might have been in 2016 when we'd had three bad election cycles. I think we now have had actually a very good election cycle, and I think that they threw everything at her but the kitchen sink, and we still won. And it strikes me that at a time when we ought to be unifying around the principle of governing, that we ought not to be having this inter-family dispute. I think that there's plenty of room for disagreement, but I think the fact that it has spilled over the way that it has is not helpful to us moving forward with actually setting an agenda and putting it in place. I mean, the principle here is that we won the election. We're going to be in a very strong position to do some of the things that we'd like to do and at least get some of that to the president's desk rather than squabbling amongst ourselves over who the Speaker of the House is going to be.
You know, Congressman, it does seem strange that in the wake of this, without doubt, a great day for Democrats, here you guys are involved in a fairly intense family squabble.
Well, I think the trouble here is that when you look at, despite what the national press says in terms of the narrative that they've developed about this election, and listen, plenty of election cycles are subject to interpretation, but in this one here, one thing is very clear. Our members that got elected, newly elected members, they won in districts that previously had been held by Republicans. They either won a seat where a Republican had retired, or they defeated a Republican. So that means by March of next year, they're likely to have opponents. And these are long-held Republican positions for the most part, including those seats in California, which have turned out to be a very good news story for us. So I think that trying to meld the different parts of the Democratic Party together, again, under the guise for sure of setting an agenda, which is very, very important, is what ought to be the priority. Now, Tip O'Neill used to say that if Democrats were in Europe, we'd be five different political parties.
Right.
And I think there's some truth to that. I mean, part of our diversity not just alone comes from gender and race, but it also comes from geography. So when I signed up or won my first seat in 88, my first election to the House, there were about 269 Democrats. That was down from the 292, I think, that Tip enjoyed in the aftermath of Watergate. But that allowed for us to control the agenda as it came to the House floor. And I think that's the paramount concern here. We have some things that we'd like to do in the Ways and Means Committee on the whole issue of what to do about pre-existing condition. I think that the administration will lean in our direction on a big infrastructure bill. And by the way, is there a city that's done better with infrastructure than Boston in my memory? I'm not aware of it. And I'd like to get on to some of these positions that we took during the campaign, understanding that an election is about forming a government, and I think that the argument over who ought to lead the party at the moment is one that we ought to try to put in the rearview mirror as quickly as possible.
Right. Are you concerned when you hear that there are 16 Democrats who say they will oppose Pelosi? In other words, it might not let this argument go into the rearview mirror just yet.
Well, we're going to have an election on the 27th. I think that's been the date that has been targeted, and that's next week. And I think at that time, one of the items that will be very clear is that she will have the overwhelming support of Democrats in that caucus. I mean, I can see her getting 85% to 90% of the Democrats in the caucus.
Right, and then that puts pressure on the folks who are holding out, I guess.
Well,
right?
It certainly changes the equation. I don't think there's much thought, much difference about that. But I also, let me just say something if I can as well, because, you know, I've served for a long time, and I think my reputation is one of being very interested in regular order and amendments and having an opportunity to make positions known that stand up under the magnifying glass. Her work on stimulus, which I think helped turn around the economy in the aftermath of a period of time at the end of the Bush administration when we were losing 800,000 jobs a month, she was the one who reconciled, as I described earlier, the different parts of the Democratic Party to put the Affordable Care Act front and center. She came up with, along with Congressman Frank at the time, Chairman Frank, the legislation that put in place Dodd-Frank. These were all major legislative accomplishments. And this idea that is depicted by Republicans that she is but a out-of-touch San Francisco liberal is nonsense. Mm. She understands, as Tip did, the idea that we are a big party with a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different voices, and that they all have to be heard and then melded into achievable public policy.
Congressman Neal, one more issue that I wanted to ask you about. When you take over as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, you've said that, among other things, you want to get hold of President Trump's tax returns. He's obviously already been asked about that. He doesn't sound like he's going to cooperate with that. I mean, are you concerned
I'm not surprised that he's not going to cooperate.
Yeah, I guess I'm not surprised either. But my question to you is, are you concerned that this will sort of, make it difficult to reach across party lines and get those important things done that you were just talking about?
Well, I'm hopeful that everybody understands that American presidents since Gerald Ford have voluntarily relinquished their tax forms. And I think here that that's still the best path to have the president do that. But if he decides not to, that we certainly intend to put in place, I think, legal reasoning and to make sure that the optics are correct and so that this doesn't sound as though it's beyond the pale of responsibility, and to, in the end, ask for the forms. I assume that, given the fact that the president said during the course of the campaign that he would release his tax forms, and then he said he couldn't because he was under audit, and then said he wouldn't, and now is saying again that he can't because he's under audit, there'll be an opportunity for perhaps the precedent that was established in during the Nixon years, simply to have the Joint Tax Committee, that is a group of professionals, tax economists, tax attorneys, CPAs and others, they would have a chance to examine part of those tax forms.
All right. That's Massachusetts Congressman Richard Neal, who come January becomes chairman of the very powerful House Ways and Means Committee. Congressman Neal, great to have you. Thanks so much
for
joining us.
Thanks for the time. All the best.
All right. Same to you. All right. Let's turn from the Democrats in Washington to the Republicans here in Massachusetts. With the exception of Governor Charlie Baker, who romped on Election Day and easily won a second term, the state's GOP, well, I guess you could say it's sort of disappearing before our eyes. The party suffered another major drubbing the week before last on Election Day. Steve Cazella, president of the Mass Inc. polling group who conducts polls for us, wrote about this in Commonwealth Magazine, and he's with us now. Hi, Steve. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
So sum it up for us. Just how badly did the Massachusetts GOP do on Election Day?
Well, you can pretty much look anywhere else on the ballot. So look, for instance, at the statewide candidates for things like attorney general or treasurer. Look at, you know, auditor, secretary of state. In all of those cases, the margins were very large. You look down at Congress, same thing. Even in the districts where some people earlier on were saying this would be where competition could happen. So down in the 9th Congressional District, for instance, where you had Peter Tedeschi challenging Bill Keating, up in the 3rd, where you actually had an open seat. Both of these were also lopsided double-digit losses. Then even in the state legislature, where there's already a pretty small Republican caucus, we also saw more Republicans, a handful of more Republicans lose their seats.
So what's going on here? I mean, you're a great observer of politics. You're also a pollster. What does your polling tell us about how Massachusetts voters view the Republican Party?
Well, we're fortunate to this particular year have some really great polling of the people who voted. So the AP and Fox News and a couple others have adopted a new way of doing exit polling. So gone are the days where you'd have someone standing out there with a clipboard, and in are the days where you've got lots of online polling, phone polling, mail polling, all kinds of things. So we get thousands of responses from right here in Massachusetts. And what those show us really is that people don't just just think that the Massachusetts, or that the, I should say, the National Republican Party is out of touch. They're actually kind of scared of it. Hmm. You see, for instance, people saying that majority saying that Republicans would rather look out for their own interests rather than look out for the country. You see very negative views of Trump. You see people thinking that Trump has either made them less safe or at least not made things any better, that Republican rhetoric is actually leading to an increase in violence. A majority think that. So on a whole bunch of measures, there's this sort of edge of fear almost, not just seeing the other party as someone who doesn't agree with you on policy, which is another thing, but actually there's an edge of fear to it.
It's interesting, though, because Charlie Baker does so well in this state, and he's a Republican, obviously, but it sounds like what you're saying, that folks don't make a distinction between the national GOP and the state GOP.
Well, it's also true that Charlie Baker was in office before the whole Trump wave started, and
right.
There's a very clear, the very clear polling that shows that the Republican Party now is much more Trump's party, and people see the two very much tied together. So, Charlie Baker won in 2014. Already was very well known, very well liked, even by the time Trump sort of came onto the stage. So I think to a certain extent, he benefits from having already been able to define his image, already been able to gain popularity before the Republican Party's, before Trump came on the stage and sort of changed the way things worked.
Interesting. But why isn't his political star power, if that's indeed what he has, and based on his numbers, it seems that he is a genuine political star. Why doesn't this political star power help his fellow Republicans in Massachusetts? Or doesn't seem to?
No, it doesn't seem to at all. I mean, I think there's a question that a couple have raised as to whether political coattails are really a real phenomenon anymore, or if they really ever were. But they certainly weren't in this election. So none of the candidates that he campaigned for, and he didn't campaign for all the Republican ticket despite endorsing it, none of the ones.
And he kind of hiccuped when he said he was going to, right? He said he was going to back the ticket and then sort of faced awkward questions about Jeff Diehl because of his support for Trump and didn't really answer that so smoothly. Right?
Right, exactly. So the ones that he did campaign for actively didn't really see any benefit as far as, more victories or anything like that. But then there were a number of them that I think were sort of emblematic of where the party has gone. So you think Jeff Diehl, you think the Republican Attorney General candidate, that he was reluctant to even say their names.
Yes,
right. Reluctant to even say, yes, I endorse Jeff Diehl, you ought to vote for him. There was sort of this awkward construction of endorsing the ticket rather than endorsing individuals and a reluctance to sort of embrace their views or anything. And I think he recognizes as much as anyone else that, Trump has 20% and 30% approval numbers in Massachusetts, worst approval rating in the country right here in the Bay State for Trump. And that's not really a center of gravity that he wants anything to do with or wants to sort of get anywhere close to.
Yeah. Does any of this suggest a path forward for Republicans? I mean, do the results mean, I think you actually suggest this in your piece, do the results mean that the state GOP needs to more closely align itself with moderates like Baker?
I think that the problems that they suffer have more to do with the National Party, and they'll benefit more when the National Party decides, or the National Party at least opens a road to a more moderate way for the Massachusetts Party to be. Until that happens, I think that other candidates that aren't already Charlie Baker, that other candidates besides Charlie Baker will really have a difficult time.
Really interesting. That's Mass Inc. Polling Group President Steve Cazella. He does polling for us here at WBUR, and you can find a link to his piece on the state Republican Party and how it appears to be disappearing at our website, radioboston.org. Steve, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
And stay with us. Coming up, a look at Betsy DeVos's proposed new rules on how colleges and universities handle sexual harassment and assault cases. Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.